We've heard a lot recently about the resurgence of General Motors. It has returned to profitability, and it's selling its stock once again on Wall Street. But what about the other company that received a government bailout? Chrysler is still struggling. Since the beginning of the year, it has lost nearly $500 million. NPR's Sonari Clinton reports on the outlook for the smallest of the Detroit three.
This week, President Obama and Vice President Biden went to a Chrysler plant in Kokomo, Indiana, to bring attention to what they call a comeback. Here's Vice President Biden.
To bring the automobile industry back, we knew we had to change things. We couldn't just keep doing the things the way we did. We knew the auto industry had to get leaner, had to get tougher, had to be more competitive.
We have a lot of ground to make up.
Sean Morgan is a Chrysler spokesperson. She says the company has gotten leaner. It has fewer employees, fewer factories, fewer dealers, and wages and benefits have been cut.
There's been a lot of challenging times, to put it mildly, in the industry and certainly for our company in the most recent past. And we've learned from that, but we're going to continue learning.
It's going to need to do that and more. The company finds itself well behind GM and Ford, and many of its products still don't compare well against the best foreign models. It's a situation Chrysler has been in before.
Well, when you've been kicked in the head like we have, you learn pretty quick to put first things first. And in the car business, product comes first. And product is what brought us back to prosperity.
That was former Chrysler CEO Lee Iacocca in one of his many TV commercials from the 1980s. This is the second bailout for Chrysler. Then, as now, Chrysler's focus is on introducing new products. Rebecca Lindland studies the car industry for IHS Automotive. Lindland says the new Chrysler and its corporate partner Fiat are taking a big risk in releasing 16 new or significantly redesigned cars.
There is a lot of expense that's going to be hitting their balance sheets while they launch these new products. But the goal is to make up that expense and to absorb that expense through increased profitability.
And Chrysler is going to be under great pressure to prove it can make money again. So far this year, it's had a net loss of $453 million. But Lindland says the bankruptcy and restructuring have given Chrysler a future.
The outlook is significantly more positive because they've been able to restructure their dealer network. They've been able to right-size the company themselves. They're hiring people from outside of the big three. And the people that are left are the ones that are really making a difference.
Lindland says when cars hit dealer showrooms, customers will notice. Tamara Darvish runs four Chrysler dealerships in Maryland and Florida. Darvish says she's already noticed a difference in Chrysler and wants me to test one out.
Are you scared? No, you just press the button. There is no key.
Oh.
Can you hear that? Feel it in your whole body sitting in that seat?
I can't lie, I do.
I mean, the Dodge Challenger is a car that you drive with your entire body and soul.
Darvish has been a Chrysler dealer for nearly 30 years. She remembers the first bailout vividly.
I want to see Chrysler reemerge as the great car company it was, and I sort of just want to have the same feeling I had as being a part of that, like we did back in the 80s.
Darvish, like many analysts, believes that given time, the company will be profitable again. The question is, how long that will take to happen? Sonari Clinton, NPR News.
All Things Considered continues in a moment. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This week, scientists in the Gulf of Mexico are taking daily dives to the seafloor in a submarine. They're getting a close look at exotic ecosystems that could be at risk because of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Later this week, they'll be the first researchers to see in person the seafloor near the blown-out oil well. Well, NPR's Richard Harris is going along on this expedition, and he's on the line now from the research ship Atlantis. And Richard, tell us exactly where you are. Where is the ship in the Gulf?
Well, Mary Louise, we're about 95 miles off the coast of Louisiana in an area called the Green Canyon. And on maps, of this part of the ocean sort of looks like a giant mud flat that eventually ends up being canyons. And we're in one of those canyons, Green Canyon. And I must say, I always thought this was kind of a boring and muddy place. But it turns out the scientists on board have already found weird and fascinating things like lakes of brine and little mud volcanoes and all sorts of wild and interesting animals.
And that's stuff that presumably would have been there anyway. Are they able to chart any of the damage yet that may have been wreaked by the oil spill?
Well, at the moment, they're operating a good distance from the well, and they've been taking daily dives with a little submarine called the Alvin. This mission was actually planned in 2007 to survey these sites with the Alvin well before the oil spill. As it happens, though, the chief scientist on this cruise is Samantha Joy from the University of Georgia, and we've heard her earlier on our air talking about the fact that she has found oil residue on the seafloor in a large area around the Macondo well. Those samples were taken from ships and so on, and Alvin is going to dive down with Samantha Joy and me, I hope, on Saturday, and we'll get the first up-close and personal view of oil on the seafloor.
Wow, sounds so exciting. So do you have any idea what you're expecting to see once you get down there to the bottom of the ocean?
Well, we're diving in an area where she took core samples before and saw actually fairly thick deposits of fluffy, oily material, actually a few inches deep on the seafloor, and the life below that in the mud had been killed. And I asked her today, what do you think we'll see this time around? And she said, well, her bet is that she's going to see more oil on the seafloor, but she doesn't know, of course. That's why we're going there. She's going to take more mud samples, and we'll bring them up in the Alvin and get a close look at this. Her observations about how much oil on the seafloor have been fairly controversial, so she hopes she'll gather some data that will help put those questions to rest.
Some hard data there. Fascinating stuff. Thanks very much, Richard.
My pleasure.
And Richard is reporting there from the research ship Atlantis out in the Gulf of Mexico. Up next for Disney, a different kind of princess. A lot has changed since the beginning of the princess genre in the late 1930s, as NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports.
Say Disney princess, and you probably think this.
Someday my prince will come. Someday we'll meet again.
Earlier Disney heroines like Snow White later gave way to feistier young women like Princess Jasmine in 1992's Aladdin.
You are the boy from the market. I knew it. Why did you lie to me?
Jasmine, I'm sorry.
Did you think I was stupid?
Disney's Princess franchise even spawned a fond parody.
Come, my little friends, as we all sing a happy little working song.
Amy Adams' Princess Giselle in 2007's Enchanted.
Closing down the garbage pail and scrubbing up the toilet. Woo!
Miley Cyrus's Hannah Montana has usurped a lot of Disney's princess audience.
Fantastic and romantic, all a big surprise.
So it's decided to move on. But that doesn't mean you won't be seeing the ladies at all. They'll still be at theme parks and in stores, and soon they'll be joined by a different kind of heroine. Rumored to be next, a fearless Scots lassie who can swash and buckle with the best of them in a movie called Brave. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Around the Thanksgiving table, family stories can be as familiar as turkey and trimmings. Those stories may recall Thanksgiving's past, filled with warmth, family lore, and occasionally disaster.
We're going to hear a disaster tale now, all in good fun. It's told by Jeffrey Riddell, a writer in New York. His story comes from The Moth Radio Hour, a public radio show where brave souls tell unscripted stories in front of a live audience. It's presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
So my last Thanksgiving ended at exactly 5 minutes after five on the fourth Thursday of November, 34 years ago. Let me explain. Both of my parents were lower middle class people with upper lower class educations. My father was a foreman in a paper mill. My mother was a bank teller. We lived in a split level house in a subdivision that went bankrupt shortly after they bought into it. Inexplicably, in January of 1974, my father came home and announced to my mother that he had sold everything and bought a farm 60 miles away. The farm turned out to be 80 acres of untilled clay, a heap of resting equipment, and two Holstein cows. They argued until my mother agreed to pack up everything and move. Everything, including her prized set of chartreuse-colored Russell Wright crystal. Within a month, my father had built a chicken coop, gotten the tractor fixed, and purchased a bull. The bull arrived and went straight to work. Now, the next 9 months went as you might expect, which is to say, farming is not for amateurs. So any mistakes that could be made were made, beginning with breeding cows in March. Our first cow went into labor and calved on Thanksgiving at 4 o'clock in the morning, this being Michigan and a particularly cold season in our unheated barn. It died less than an hour later. Now, seeing his assets frozen on the barn floor drove my father to take desperate steps to protect his remaining investment. So he covered the floor of our family room with a large plastic tarp, put down a bed of straw, and brought the remaining cow into the house to have its calf. By noon, both mother and calf were warm and sleeping in the room next to our kitchen. My father put a bale of straw in front of the doorway between the two rooms to keep them in place. Now, while we were tending to the calves, my mother was in the kitchen, banging pots and pans and muttering about it being a family room, not a maternity ward sort of thing. Now, every Thanksgiving, it was my mother's custom to remove from her china cabinet one small, pale green crystal cordial glass into which she would pour a single jigger of sherry to sip while she cooked. At no other time did my mother drink, and to the best of my knowledge, no other piece of crystal was ever used. Now, she loved this crystal. She used to brag that that crystal was the only thing she had that wasn't second rate or second hand. So, the afternoon goes on, relatives arrive. My grandmother makes a comment about, "What is that awful smell?" But a sharp glance from my mother is enough to keep her from making it a second time. At 5 o'clock exactly, turkey is put on the table. We all sit down to dinner, and my grandfather says grace. Now, while God is being distracted by my grandfather, a lesser spirit overcomes the calf, and it leaps over the bale of straw and comes charging into the kitchen and crashes into the table. What happens next happens really fast. My mother screams. She grabs her cordial glass, stands up, knocking over her chair in the process. My father, more startled by my mother's screams than anything, sort of half stands, half lunges at the calf, which by now has its nose in his plate. I will never forget that slow motion look of horror on my mother's face as she watches my father rise a little bit and reach for, but not quite reach, equilibrium before falling backward into the china cabinet. Somehow my father escaped injury, but every single piece of crystal shattered. Everything save the one glass in my mother's hand. Now, for a child watching all of this unfold, it was fantastic. But that was our last Thanksgiving together. And for the remainder of their marriage, that glass sat on my mother's dressing room table with her wedding ring in it. For all the years in between, on the fourth Thursday of every November, my mother took great pleasure in preparing a dinner of roasted veal. Thank you.
That's storyteller and writer Jeffrey Riddell with a Thanksgiving to remember, and we hope yours is every bit as memorable, maybe a little less dramatic.
That story comes from the Moth Radio Hour, produced by Jay Allison of Atlantic Public Media and presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You can hear all of the Moth Radio Hour at npr.org. This is NPR.
And 60 million Americans say they plan to shop this Thanksgiving weekend. Black Friday, of course, is the traditional start of the holiday shopping season, but many retailers are well ahead of the curve. They've been promoting Black Friday specials for weeks in an effort to get an early jump on sales. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Stores will be opening very early Friday morning. In fact, some will open tomorrow, Thanksgiving Day. Consumers are expected to spend a bit more than last year, but they're doggedly looking for good deals, which are often found online.
Just did a fun little thing with Groupon. Are you familiar with that on Facebook?
Ben and Alyssa Helton, with a new baby in tow, have just come from a Nordstrom rack in a suburban Seattle shopping center. An online site was offering $50 rack gift cards for just $25. They bought two of them. Ben Helton, like so many others, has taken a pay cut this year, so he's being very selective.
We're going to have to look for better deals.
If we spend over $300, I'll be really sad.
Yeah, it definitely, that's probably our cap.
That's less than average. Consumers surveyed for the National Retail Federation said they plan to spend $518 on gifts, or $11 more than they spent last year. Increasingly, says Ellen Davis of the Retail Federation, shoppers will pay for the gifts not with credit cards, but with debit cards and cash.
The number of people who will use credit cards as a primary form of payment is at its lowest level since 2002. What that tells us is that people are out there spending on a budget. They're very conscious of how much they've set aside for the holiday season, and they don't want to overextend themselves.
Technology is having a profound effect on shopping habits. More than ever, shoppers are using social media sites to get ideas, read reviews, and compare prices. And speaking of price, many expect to use their mobile devices to guide them to a store and then once inside to see if the price they're looking at is the best one available. But many consumers will skip the mall altogether. While online shopping is still just a small part of overall retail, it's growing because of people like Tina Estes.
I can armchair shop at midnight if I can't sleep. I don't have to deal with parking and crowds, and it's just more convenient.
More internet than last year?
Yeah, I've already done more internet this year than last year.
And what are they buying online? Craig Berman of Amazon.com showed me some of the most popular stuff for kids, beginning with something called Pillow Pets.
This is a pig, a pink pig, and we have a purple unicorn. Now, these look like stuffed animals, but then if you roll them over, you can unhook the strap, and it turns into a pillow.
Other hot items include a new variation of Scrabble and a talking robot.
Look out!
Aside from toys, Amazon shoppers are buying book readers, GPSs, and lots of things made by Apple. And for the first time, they can post a gift card purchase to someone's Facebook wall. Gift cards, it turns out, remain the number one item on holiday wish lists. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. And this morning we're looking ahead to another Thanksgiving and another round of traditional foods that can be bland, soggy, and frankly unappealing. But it is not too late to snap your meal out of the doldrums. Let's welcome Chris Kimball, host of the PBS show America's Test Kitchen, who's here to walk us through a redo of traditional dishes.
This is a Thanksgiving makeover.
Some of the makeovers have to do with food that we know are traditional, maybe loved as children, but really don't want to serve now.
Thanksgiving's full of culinary hurdles. Roasting the turkey, it's the white meat versus the dark meat. You undercook the white meat or you overcook the white meat. You do an apple pie, it serves eight. It took you 3 hours to make it. You can't serve the other eight people at the table. You have stuffing, it's either in the bird, you don't have enough stuffing to serve everybody, or it's done in the oven separately, and then it doesn't have all the juices. So, you know, this is high stress, the biggest day of the year. So we're gonna try to solve all these problems.
Our first makeover, the turkey. Chris Kimball says it's all too easy to dry out the white meat and undercook the dark meat. The fault, he says, lies not with you, but with Mother Nature. Turkeys were clearly never designed to be roasted.
The construct of a turkey is a disaster. You have this huge cavity in the inside that doesn't conduct heat very well, so you have uneven cooking. So we're going back to a method. Actually, Julia Child invented this, or at least she popularized it. She would break down her turkey into parts and cook the parts.
You don't need to cut up the turkey yourself. Just buy one that's already disassembled. Breast, legs, and thighs. Brush on some melted butter, sprinkle on a little salt and pepper, and place into a 275-degree oven.
It's on a wire rack set over a jelly roll pan or baking sheet. And underneath it are celery, onion, and carrot. The juices come down from the turkey parts onto the vegetables, and we use those vegetables as the basis for the gravy.
The drawback? You lose that Norman Rockwell moment
when you bring out a magnificent golden turkey to oohs and ahs from guests seated around the table. But let's not forget, this is a Thanksgiving makeover.
The question is it about the food or is it about the presentation? So we're focused here on the food. You know, you can take a painting of Norman Rockwell and put it on the wall. You can wear a bow tie, but you want perfectly cooked white meat, perfectly cooked dark meat. This is the way to do it.
With the turkey cooking, it's time to move on to the stuffing. Traditionally, you'd make it inside the bird, but that's obviously not an option in this case.
We ain't got a bird.
We don't have a bird.
We just got parts. We got bird parts. We don't have a bird.
And the problem, when you try and bake stuffing, I'm sorry, it's really hard to make it taste good.
The question is, how do you get all the juices from the bird into the stuffing? Which is, if you don't do that, you don't have a lot of flavor.
The answer, to bake the stuffing along with some turkey wings, which you sauté first. When the wings are nice and brown, throw in some celery, onions, and a little broth so you have a base. Then add the bread.
We start with cube bread. You have to dry it out. If you just let this sit on the counter, there's still going to be a lot of moisture in the bread. So you end up with soggy.
Soggy.
We've solved the problem of soggy stuffing. If you actually put these bread cubes in the oven, the moisture inside the bread cubes evaporates. So now we have bread cubes that actually really are dry.
Chris beats up some eggs and adds them to the mix. Dried cherries and cooked sausage go in as well. Eventually, everything gets poured into a buttered casserole dish. Then an innovation. Place those sautéed turkey wings on top of the stuffing mixture and cover the entire dish with foil.
Okay, we're going to put that in a 375 oven for about an hour and 50 minutes or so.
And while it bakes, the juices from the wings drip down into the stuffing, infusing it with that inside-the-bird flavor. You end up with perfect stuffing, all thanks to what Chris calls the trickle-down theory. Time now for a mashed potato makeover. If you're fed up with a dry, bland, potatoey lump, try this, whipped potatoes.
About 1930, the Sunbeam Mixmaster came along. It was one of the great success stories of the 20th century in terms of kitchen appliances. One of the settings was whipped potatoes. This is a lost recipe. We've always said in the test kitchen, don't whip your potatoes because they get that gluey texture. It turns out you can, using a standing mixer or a hand mixer, not a food processor, you can whip potatoes, and they're incredibly light.
You said this was a lost recipe. This was not lost in my family. This was absolutely, to this day, the only way the potatoes are done at Thanksgiving.
So I should have just called you.
Exactly.
You could have saved me
yourself
weeks
many
of testing.
Steps.
Call Renee for lost recipe hotline.
Okay, so let me start you off. Fill a stock pot with peeled russet potatoes cut into 1-inch squares.
Steam them. Then we drain them. We put the potatoes back in that hot Dutch oven or stock pot because it's really important for whipped potatoes to be light. You want to get a lot of liquid out. And then we put them in the mixer. We'll do it right now.
While mixing, add in some warm milk and melted butter. It only takes about 2 minutes for the potatoes to be transformed into a fluffy white masterpiece.
So they're nice and light.
It looks like a cloud. It's beautiful.
Time now for dessert. And a makeover for the traditional apple pie. Among the traditional downsides of this homey dessert, its filling can be runny, its bottom crust soggy, and it's a lot of work for just a few slices. Chris Kimball's solution?
It's called apple slab pie. It looks like a huge Pop-Tart.
It begins with two ready-made store-bought pie crusts rolled out into a big sheet.
We took some animal crackers. I told you this would be fun. Animal crackers and sugar. Put them in a food processor. Crunched them down to essentially a dust, put that on the counter, and then rolled out the two pie doughs to get about a, you know, the size, 19 by 12 roughly, of the size of a half baking sheet. Now we have drained apples, and you can help me if you want. We're just going to take these and shingle them.
Like this?
Apples, that's
shingle
right.
Shingle them as in we're laying down a roof.
Yeah. What's happening here, since we've sugared the apples, is we're getting a lot of concentrated apple flavor. And you can serve, you know, 20 people with this.
And the secret ingredient that makes apple slab pie set up, instant tapioca. After the apples are laid out, cover them with another large sheet of pie dough. It takes about an hour to bake, and when it's cooled, paint it with a glaze made from confectioner's sugar, milk, apple, and lemon juice.
And now we're going to see if you like it.
First of all, it's lovely. The glaze looks like ceramics glaze. One of these days I'm going to say I don't like one of these dishes.
Is today the day, or is today not the day?
This is not the day.
I made it another year.
This is lovely. Chris, happy Thanksgiving. If I had a glass, I'd toast you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Chris Kimball is host of America's Test Kitchen and a regular ambassador of food come Thanksgiving at Morning Edition. You can find some how-to photos and all of today's recipes, no makeover required, at our website. Plus a few more like slow cooker green bean casserole and old-fashioned pecan pie made with real maple syrup and molasses, no corn syrup. Also this holiday season, we're exploring how people use cooking apps for their mobile devices. We're interested in your experience. Send a tweet to @MorningEdition to tell us more.